Now, leading off today's program, Bill Resnick talks with Diane Feely in what I believe is the second part of a two-part interview. Diane Feely is coordinator of a national organization for women who has devoted her life to working in the labor movement and near all the social movements towards democratic socialist revolution. They discuss how to work with movements like Medicare for All or clean renewable energy or jobs for all at a living wage or housing for the poor, all toward winning movement gains and also building knowledge of and commitments to radically democratic reconstruction. Bill?
Hi, Diane Feely. Welcome to KABU.
Good morning.
Diane Feely worked a lot of jobs after college. She was a school teacher, a typesetter, spent at least 10 years on the assembly lines in Detroit, first with Ford and then with a spinoff of GM. It's called American Axle. In those years in Detroit and on the assembly line, she organized to build shop floor power, democratize the United Auto Workers. She was also active in Detroit and spent much of her life in Detroit, active through the years in many of the social movements, housing, redlining, minimum wage struggles, reproductive rights, civil rights, clean air and water, and of course challenging police violence, indeed the whole criminal justice system. And she remains now super active after retiring, mostly on Social Security, but some union pension and union medical care, very important. She also edits now and writes in the journal Against the Current. So, Diane Feely, there's tremendous ferment, excitement, activism on the left. Ordinary folks are coming to realize that our current economic arrangements are devastating the environment and undermining working people at every level. And very remarkably, people are now intrigued by the idea of socialism and are souring on capitalism. It seems to me we can now put radical critique and radical program that another better, sustainable, and democratic world is necessary and possible, that we can put that on the agenda in politics at every level and also in daily life, at work, and in the home. You've been doing that for many years. So, Diane Feely, give us an example of how you've worked for these many years in labor struggles to build radical ideas and activate people.
Well, generally speaking, it happens around campaigns, and I would say the most important idea is solidarity, and that solidarity isn't just a slogan, a nice slogan, a moral issue, but it's actually a way of uniting us and protecting us. And in my plant, we had to vote on whether we were for two-tier wages or not. So we developed a campaign around that, and the leadership, almost complete leadership, said we had to support the idea of going to two-tier wages, that is, where we would make the top wage, but anyone coming in after us would make half of what we made and would have inferior benefits. But this would be done in order to keep the plant open. And otherwise, we would all be without a job. And we countered by developing a campaign against two-tier and saying that, in fact, the way unions survive is to protect the various generations of workers. And those who came before us fought not only for their wages and benefits, but fought for the conditions that we inherited. And we had to do the same to pass the torch, and that the idea of voting for a two-wage system would actually hurt us in the sense of it would mean that we would be encouraged or intimidated into working harder, working more intensely, because we could get fired. And what would be the payoff? Well, two people could be hired for the price that we were earning. And people actually understood that and voted to oppose two-tier. Unfortunately, we weren't able to carry the campaign out to the other plants that were owned by the same corporation, so it was imposed upon us. But I think we can say, in general, workers now understand how two-tier just exacerbates inequality, and that more and more of us are working without any kind of job security. Even if we've got higher than average wage, usually there's very few benefits. So I think that idea has been tested over time, and that the idea of solidarity among generations and among different kinds of people, because obviously there are all these more vulnerable parts of the population need to be defended and can be best defended through the idea of solidarity. The other point is that it puts the burden of organizing on us, on the rank and file, rather than allowing the leadership to essentially mobilize when they wish to or sell us a bill of goods.
And people get activated then, right? They talk to their friends and they begin in all of those discussions recognizing how power is wielded by the company and also by a lot of the people at the union who have been co-opted and earn really good salaries. Tell us about the activation of workers that come with that kind of campaign.
So we were unable to get the union to put out a button saying no two-tier. But I told my president, I want to get a button into the plant that people could wear. And she said to me, well, why don't you put out a leaflet and ask for contributions? And I did, and I was quite shocked that people were coming over and giving me a dollar bill, $5 bill. So we printed up 2,000 buttons and put out a little half sheet explaining the idea of why we were opposed to two-tier. And we actually had 50 people in the various plants that would get the button out and explain this. And one night I was sitting in the break room, and this guy I had never seen before, who came from another plant, is explaining why he was against two-tier using my arguments. And I felt like, wow, we have won. Everybody understands this. Well, there were a few people who didn't, but in general, the majority of people got it and were able to tell others about it. So that was a wonderful experience, as was later we had a strike. And one skilled trades guy said to me, you know, I never used to hang out with production people, but having gone through this strike, I'm united with them. Well, this is a white worker, skilled worker, who's saying this about an essentially black and female assembly line worker. So what he's saying is, again, about the need for solidarity.
You know, I know that in 2008, you folks organized a caravan to go to Washington. Why don't you talk about the caravan and the kind of consciousness that you were building about how what in fact should happen to the all of those bankrupt auto plants?
Well, you know, here we work in an industry that I don't believe in. I don't believe we should be making cars and SUVs and trucks. So at the time of the crisis, we were able to not just talk within the plant, but have a much larger conversation about what could the auto industry contribute. And we talked about it's an emergency right now in a double sense, not only a financial emergency, but a climate emergency. And just as during World Wars I and II, Detroit stopped making cars and started making war material, now in this emergency, we could become the vanguard for what needs to be produced to stop and slow down the processes that are creating the CO2 and really become a model of what industry can do. And the other point that we make is that there's nothing magic about a 40-hour work week. In fact, many auto plants, including a Ford plant that I worked in, we worked far more than 40 hours a week. One plant, I worked 50 hours one week, 58 hours the next week. That was our usual pace. So people didn't have lives. We need lives and not just money to work. So I think these are important points to raise, and also to challenge one of the things that everyone says in our society, the economists, the media, even leaders in the union, they're always talking about growth, how our society has to grow. You know, in Europe, they talk about degrowth because we can't keep growing every year, producing more CO2, using up more resources. we have to find a way of valuing other things, music, education, developing a social life. So these are the things that we try to raise instead of just talking about wages and benefits.
This is your OMO Variety Hour on KABU, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Diane Feely, a woman who did graduate college and went out in the work world and decided to become an organizer. She's done it in schools as a typesetter and especially as a member of the United Auto Workers working in the American Axle plant in Detroit, Michigan, and also active in all the social movements in Detroit and Michigan, including now, of course, the environmental movement. We've been talking about how one works in those movements to build popular consciousness of that other, better possible world. And we deserve it, and we can stand for it, and in solidarity we can collectively run it. Those are all some of the ideas that she was discussing. So how do you think that your caravan, for example, and other stuff that you've done, I know you visited plants in Mexico that, in fact, were worker-run, a tire plant, and you try and bring that message back and seed people's imagination that another better world is possible, that really we can work democratically together in solidarity instead of fighting one another around the world for the crumbs. To what extent do you think that those ideas have become parts of working class consciousness? Not that they don't also have ideas about how you have to defend yourself and work harder in order to stay afloat and get privileges for your kids. That's part of American life too. But I think they're beginning to realize that that other world is necessary and that it's possible.
Right. I mean, obviously this is still very much of a minority point of view. I think there's two components. One is that most unions, and certainly my union, the UAW, sees things from the boss's point of view. That is, they believe that we have to negotiate with the company from the point of view of keeping them open and presumably producing the products that they're currently producing. That is, workers have no say in any aspect of production. And that position has been detrimental not only to the solidarity within the union as a way of keeping ourselves strong, but it's also led to tremendous corruption. So now the UAW leadership is facing charges, and actually some of them have been recently sentenced to prison. But the UAW was never like, say, the Hoffa Union. It was always sort of seen as a very clean union in which the top leaders didn't make that much more than the skilled tradesmen. So this is a big turnaround, and the reason is because of the cooperation between union and management that developed, especially around a team. We have to be a team, joint production, really essentially since the early 80s. The other idea that I wanted to raise, which is one that is becoming more popular, I wouldn't say necessarily it's at the rank and file level, but at least it's being talked about among activists, and that is the notion of just transition, that we are now in a situation where we cannot go on the way we are, and that the level of inequality and the level of climate change is so great that we have to change our ways of doing things. And in this just transition, we must take into account the workers who are working in the plants that have to be closed down or refitted, and the communities that surround them, which in some cases are the poorest communities and the ones that suffer from the most air pollution and toxic waste of all of us, and that these are the people that must come first in terms of understanding if we're going to make this transition, it must be done justly. That is, we must end the terrible inequality of our society.
This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking to Diane Feely. We're talking about the changing consciousness of particularly among the young, but everywhere, of the American working class and the movements that are developing. She's been working in all of them. Diane, it seems to me within the energy system, there's a consensus that we have to move towards renewable energy. The fossil fuel companies don't share that, but coal is both expensive and unhealthy, and the plants are closing, and new coal plants are not being even planned, although they do seem to think that you can do carbon capture, but basically that's all so expensive. But still, the investor-owned utilities, the corporate structure, they want to maintain their control of electricity, and they're trying to build their system. On the other side, though, there's like a state of California, which has gone the furthest. There's really the possibility of local distributed energy, that is, a lot of small installations and some larger ones producing electricity. And in fact, they'd be public agencies. Alameda County has now taken all of the customers of Pacific Gas and Electric, and that's its big investor-owned utility. It's like 500,000 customers, a big part of that company and its profits. And all of those people are now being served by East Bay Community Energy, it's called, that is now offering rates. The rates are cheaper than what the PG&E is charging its other customers. It's more resilient, and it's building out local energy. And this would be democratically managed, provide local jobs, and also bring together many other movements in Alameda County, which is Oakland and Berkeley and Hayward, and some working class suburbs, some richer suburbs, and bring together all of the movements for public transit, for local food, for radically changing the way we live, for less working hours. They're bringing that all together into a movement that is, in fact, now inspiring people all over California. Almost every county now is moving towards, counties and cities are moving towards taking over their energy systems in one way or another. It seems to me that the energy system also offers this tremendous opportunity to talk about democratic organization and democratic running of the productive capacity of this country.
Yes, and I think one of the points that you make about municipalization is very important. And a lot of cities do own energy or water locally, and so that's a great beginning. Unfortunately, Detroit is really not in that situation. We have a big energy company that has about 10% at this point in renewables, and they're rolling out their plan and having a town hall meeting this Tuesday night in Detroit, and many activists are going to be going to that. What the energy company is saying is, we are committed to renewables, but at a very slow pace, because all of this has to be done on the consumer's dime, and we don't want to cause you very high rates. We don't want your rates to be going up. Well, we want to present a different perspective and use the meeting to try to educate folks about the fact that there's another way of doing this.
And it's a way of doing it that might save the planet. It's true, at their pace, because they have to recover all of their stranded costs. They can't have stranded costs. They can't have both a coal plant working or natural gas plants working at, and also then move towards renewables, you would have a huge excess of electricity then. So they want to pay off their assets, that is, amortize them, get all the profits possible out of them, and then move towards renewable energy. Well, of course, the planet is warming and warming and warming, and California is burning. That's not a feasible program, and it's not a feasible program to make the people pay. It really has to be the investment houses who have funded all of this stuff, and in fact, the rich. We have to mobilize as if in World War II, and some of those rich people are going to have to sacrifice.
Climate change is a big problem, not only because of the amount of CO2 that we're putting in the air, but the pace has accelerated. And what we have to do is really move into reverse, and to reverse very quickly, because essentially the IPCC report indicates that we've got 12 years to basically cut CO2 in half. So it's we've got this dozen years, and we've got to use it well.
Yes, I think that we're near a point where people are going to begin rising up around that program. I hope so. I hope in our lifetime. Diane Feely, thanks a lot. Keep up the good work. I know that's, I don't have to urge you to it. You've had a lifetime of it. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Right.